There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the Phidias Club. This is episode 123 for February 2019. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Phidias Club. In this show, what we do is that we get people from different countries, different parts of the world. We get together and we talk about what's been happening in our, well, I was going to say lives. I guess part of it is that, but also what's been happening in our countries and in the world in general. And we get different perspectives, different angles, different cultural backgrounds interpreting the events of the world. Hopefully, you get something out of it. We get fun out of it. Well, fun is the hope. Sometimes it's terrible depression and darkness. We'll see what this episode has in store for us. It's a surprise every time. First, let me welcome the guests. As I said, my name is Patrick Beja, and I am from France. I am currently living in Finland. You also have in this episode the return, the triumphant return of Marlene from the Netherlands. How's it going, Marlene? It's been forever.
Yes, it has been forever indeed. All is well. So, yeah, looking forward to the show.
All is well. I guess that's as long as it's not, everything is terrible, I think we should be happy. So,
well, you know, we still have populism and the extreme right on the rise. So everything is well up to a point.
Okay, that's more likely, that's more akin to what I was expecting. We also have Wendy back on the show. Wendy is, previously from Sweden, and now back in the US.
Yes, hello.
I see that you are also unhappy about your current circumstances.
It's good and bad. It's a mixed bag, but I don't know, you know, there's some cold weather over here. So I feel like I'm sort of still in Sweden.
Yeah, you basically moved back to the Sweden of the US. So yeah. I can understand. Well, I'll ask you a ton of things about that in just a little bit. But first, let me welcome the third co-host on the show. Dan Campos is back from Mexico. How's it going, sir?
Hi there. Well, I am pretty much ready for this show and also ready to discuss, because this seemed to be perhaps the best of times and for some maybe the worst of times. I say that we are living interesting times, so we're ready to discuss about that.
All right, let's talk about interesting times indeed. And before we do, though, I do want to thank and salute the heroes of this episode who woke up at 5 a.m. in the morning to be on the show, namely Wendy and Dan. Thank you so much. I raise my glass to your health.
Yep.
So I guess I am so curious about what happened with you, Wendy, that I'm going to start with you, if that's okay.
Sure.
So you were kind of the other person on the show that was defending the ideals of social democracy in Europe and in Northern Europe and saying how good it was and how great it was and how well it worked. And now you've left. You've abandoned me. What happened?
I know. First of all, I still absolutely believe in those things and will defend them to my death.
Okay.
I think it had a lot more to do with the reality of spending the first 35 years of your life in the United States. So all of our sort of building up of, you know, ability to live life was done here. And so, you know, we moved to Sweden. My husband got a master's degree there. And unlike every student he knew, he had to pay for his schooling. So right there was a big chunk of savings. And then, it was expensive. It was really hard to afford a house. We have four kids, so it's a lot of us. Mm. And so we could hardly find housing. And, you know, when we did, it was camping. It was fun. I loved it. We had all of us in one bathroom for a while. So,
you spent what, 3 years there?
Four years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we really debated. I mean, really, truly debated. But when it came down to, you know, and how it works in the States is you sort of build credit over time, and then a bank will loan you money to buy a house, you know, and you have to save so much to do that. It's kind of, you know, we know how that works, and that's how we have done it. And we get there and they're like, well, it's very different and we don't know who you are. So it's as if we were, you know, 17. So that made it a little tough. And then, you know, timing with kids. I remember actually, Patrick, I believe it was you at Nerdtacular 1 year, you had talked to me about when you were 13 or something when your parents moved you.
Yes,
somewhere.
Is that, absolutely. Right? Yeah. Okay. We spent a year in Cyprus and a year in Lebanon, and it wasn't easy.
That's right. And you had said, don't ever do that to your children. And you were in the back of my head when we were about to make that decision this spring, because our son is 13, turned 13 in the summer. And I was like, we are dooming him. This is going to be terrible.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think it's different when you go back to the place where you're from.
Right.
And even though I am actually from that neighborhood, I hadn't known it for all my life. So I think it was different.
Right. But, right. And my kids have been really funny. They you know, they've never met Trump supporters before in their lives. And so they are having all sorts of interactions they never thought they would. And they've made a lot of comments like, you know, Americans do this and, you know,
oh, really?
That's how they still see the world. And it's pretty funny. And it's true. Americans do weird stuff. And so in their minds, they're kind of too cultured now. And yeah, it's also very familiar. And the language, of course, is easy. And so it's been a good move. And we chose Minnesota. So my husband actually still works for this company in Sweden that he worked for before. And I can kind of work from anywhere. So we just threw a dart at the map and tried to choose the Sweden of America, which this is where the Swedes stopped when they immigrated here. They came here. And it's because of the lakes. There's lakes everywhere. And that's how Sweden is. So there's that. Plus, you know, they've created quite the functional community here. So we are benefiting from the Swedish ancestry, at least.
And I mean, it's not just about the weather. We were joking before we started recording that there's some kind of healthcare system as well. There's some social safety nets in Minnesota.
There are in the sense of it's a state that's just run well. And I will, you know, let's get political real fast, is it is a purple state, which is why we chose it. I don't want to live where everyone believes all the same thing. And here you've got a good mix of both liberal and conservatives and, you know, very polite. Everyone is very nice. So, you know,
It's your neighbors that you, that's kind of what we try to do on the show, get you to actually talk to the people that think differently. But I think when it's your neighbors and people that you interact with all the time, it's kind of difficult to be as antagonistic as people often are in the media or on social media, I guess.
Right. And I have asked a few friends here, like, how do you know how to talk about it, or how does it get brought up? And, you know, and there's just a general overlying politeness that is expected. Mm. It's like we're like the American Canadians. And my son said, he said, Minnesotans are like Canadians with guns. So we do not have this sort of healthcare safety net that you would be thinking of, but we have a pretty functional version. And, you know, Obamacare has really benefited. My experience is I skipped all Obamacare and I came back and had to buy my own insurance here. And it's expensive. But sort of Minnesota has made a bunch of rules that make sure that kids have coverage and dental care and some other stuff.
I have expected you to say they've made a bunch of rules to make sure that kids have guns. You didn't go that route. No. You know, I've been thinking for a while, I would love to do a special episode on expatriates and people who experience different cultures and who maybe even come back to where they were from, and how they see the world differently or their country differently after that. I think that's an interesting thing to discuss. Maybe we should do something like that in the next few months.
Have lots of thoughts on that.
I'm sure you do. And I do as well. And many people who have been on the show have had those sorts of experiences. So let's think about that for a future show. But since you're already, talking, Wendy, let's go with your local stories or, you know, whatever has been making the news in the Sweden of America. What's up in the US or in Minnesota?
Well, it's really cold. and maybe no one's paying attention or worried about us over here, but we have definitely had a crazy cold winter. Now, for us, of course, we're like, okay, is this how it is here? And because, you know, we've never actually lived here. We did live in Vermont many years ago, and that place is just real. That's real winter. So I'm going to talk in Fahrenheit here, but for those who need Celsius, I can do that as well. But negative 40 is where Celsius and Fahrenheit meet.
Okay.
And this January, end of January, we had 4 days that we called it the polar vortex. And it's where these polar winds blow down and they kind of just go right. It's kind of like a knife going right through the center of the U.S. and makes this V shape and all the way down to the south. So there was, you know, some freezing temperatures in Florida and Georgia and, you know, and that's where the crops all die when it gets too cold. Mm. And so it was minus 46.
Jesus.
So it was pretty crazy. So we did lots of fun experiments. You can boil water, take it outside, throw it straight up in the air, and it evaporates immediately. It's amazing. And that's the extent of how fun it is. So that is a thing. And it's kind of, we have another week of it hitting, and these are temperatures that are sort of minus 20, 25 degrees Fahrenheit, lower than typical. So we really are having a weird winter. So it is it's a thing. And I think it's starting to affect, like we had snow in Hawaii a little bit where there's never been snow before. Blanket of snow in Seattle, which is very uncommon. A couple other places that just don't ever see snow. Up here, I think it's just normal. Everyone's like, oh, it's a Tuesday. Yeah. So, not
I
a
guess,
big deal.
You know, I'm sure that Dan and even Marlene, to an extent, are hearing this and going like, this is like the moon. What are you talking about? It's funny because we also had, it's my first full winter in countryside Finland. And thankfully, it let up in February, which was earlier than previous years. But if it hadn't, I've been complaining about this on Twitter, it would probably have been one of the snowiest winters in recorded history. January was the most snow the country had ever seen in a month of January. So it was crazy. We had minus 20 degrees centigrade, which is pretty darn cold,
it's
not
close.
Minus 40, but pretty cold for, I guess, a week, but it was hovering between minus 10 and minus 20 for a good while. And mostly it was the snow that kept falling to the point that, maybe I've mentioned it on the show, I've never experienced snow not melting. It falls. Yeah. And there it stays, you know? And so you have to put it somewhere. And at some point, you don't have any more room for the snow and it keeps falling. It was getting like to be a real concern at some point, but thankfully it started getting a little bit warmer. But the point I was going to make is it's also the first time I've experienced this. So for me, it's like, all right, I guess that's how winters are around these parts. But apparently it's not always that bad. So I have hope for next year. But I guess it was a little bit of the same experience for you.
Yeah. And you know, this is funny because I think weather has a lot to do with why Scandinavia works the way it does. At least that's my theory. I have a friend who works for the UN and they've done actually quite a bit of research on climate and how it impacts various countries and sort of behavior, human behavior, and we know a lot about.
You have to work together, or you're screwed. Yeah. Essentially,
exactly. You'll be dead, and if you don't prep and you don't think things through, you're gonna all die. You know. Yeah. Together. So I think there's some relatability there with Minnesota. I think, you know, you really would die. Like you have to take care of your homeless here in a very different way, or there would be just dead frozen bodies everywhere. Like you can't ignore that problem. Like you can probably get away with in California and other places. So it's funny because the local news in Sweden feels very similar to the local news here. It's, you know, like I just pulled up, what is the most recent news? And it's like, world record for longest ice hockey pass is set in the state of Minnesota. Stuff like that. Or like, hey, snowplow workers are working overtime because of snow. Yeah. Or and things that are very civic minded, like, you know, we're going to create a better immigrant defense fund. These two counties. I mean, it's very, very Swedish, actually. It's great.
Yeah. So no, it's interesting.
Local stuff is fun. National stuff, that's another story.
Do you want to discuss it, or should we keep it for another time? I guess it's the thing is, it feels very similar. I don't know that it would bring anything to the table to talk about all of this again, but I don't know. It's your call.
Well, and maybe it'd be interesting to hear from the three of you what you think about maybe as a bigger picture of, like, just as a main, like, diet in the U.S. is, what is Trump doing constantly? What illegal activity of people in his close circle, you know, that type of thing. I just wonder, what do you guys think of all that?
Yeah, I think so. I'll go to Dan and Marlene in a second. For me, it's getting a little bit tiring. Of course, there's the Trump and Un meeting that's happening in a couple of days. We've heard about that a lot. But all of the investigations and testimonies and all of that, which seem to reveal more and more levels of illegal, questionable behavior, it's kind of, all right, I think we get it. And at this point, I'm waiting for the final, this is what happened, this is how it turns out, this is what was illegal, this is what wasn't. Because my filter is social media. And on social media, essentially, every weekend, it's like, did you see this incredibly impeachment? Like, oh, that's it, we're gonna... And I'm like, all right, is it like that every weekend? I get that there's bad stuff and probably actually illegal stuff, actionable, condemnable stuff happening. But I don't know. It's as it does on everyone, it's wearing on me a little bit. Dan, what do you think? Are you hearing about all of this as well?
Yeah, it actually perhaps is not as on the news as it used to be when Trump first came to the presidency in the U.S. But it's also similar to what you mentioned, Patrick, where we're kind of tired about that. And also because it reflects in a way what is also happening in our country. So it's like, oh, yes, we have problems of corruption, of shady deals or stuff that perhaps shouldn't be happening with a governor that it's working at in the United States. Oh, same, like it's exactly the same that we're having right now in here. And in some particular situations, for example, the trade deals, that it's one of the constants that have been perhaps more in the news in here when it comes to the United States, because it affects the most all the deals and the aftermath, perhaps, of the NAFTA renewal. It's something that it's more, in this case, more important for us, because the rest is like, well, yeah.
It's very local to the U.S.,
Exactly, at least in this particular situation.
Yeah, it does feel like, I mean, it's not to diminish the issues that are being presented, but it does feel like maybe some of those things, if they had happened under a different presidency, would have led to more, more, maybe even outrage, and definitely more judicial action. But it's also like, well, the investigations aren't over, so by the time they're over, maybe it will lead to that, but... Yeah. Marlene, what about you? Is it also, business as usual for the crazy U.S.?
I think there's two We have two flavors of more of the same. There's no end to this story. And one of them is indeed basically any story about investigations into Trump, because by now we're like, so it's been proven that, you know, bad stuff happened. So now more investigations. Okay, more investigations. And then the other thing that that is the endless continuing story is the Brexit story.
We've heard about this a lot. I think in this instance, we were talking about the U.S. specifically and the investigations into the Trump campaigns. Yeah.
It's more of the same. I think that's the theme for everyone.
Yeah. Wendy, the investigation isn't over, right? It hasn't released its conclusion. Mueller is still working.
No. And I think, and this is where, the perspective from the outside, I think, would drive me crazy. I can imagine just like enough of this, and how are you guys all this corrupt, and what is the deal, right? But an insider perspective and living here, it's interesting. Again, just sort of like people have to get on with their lives, and they do, but there's this overarching feeling of like, just nobody is trustworthy. And I think ultimately the psychology of what Trump has created is incredibly important for everyone to sort of understand, and especially for Americans. I mean, we sort of are living the life of the abused partner. You know what I mean? Where we get smacked around a lot, and sort of the idea that justice will ever be served is dangled in front of us, and that, you know, order will be restored is not there. And so I think, you know, we sort of are exhausted and act like it. But I think one of the things that Trump does in particular, and you know, if any other president in history had this many people around him who had felony convictions, not just are accused, but I mean, it's unreal. Nixon, he was the guy. There was a couple bad eggs with him, and that was it. And it took years for that investigation to be completed. So I think part of it is our quickness of expecting results. Is a little different, right? We want to hear now. And that's why you have article after article going, is this the time, you know, because this investigation is way faster than any other in the history probably ever was, and really complicated. And now the fight will be, is it going to be made public or not? So we have every step of the way, we've got way too many lawyers, and we've got way too, you know, so the satisfaction of the average person to find out what the truth is feels really elusive. And that is draining. It is draining.
So do you think there will be a conclusion to this? Like, will it be made public, or is there a date where we think, okay, you know, Mueller is going to work for another 6 months, or is it going to be 4 years?
Right. We don't know. But what happens is the guy who was appointed to be the Department of Justice, the head, he determines if that report is leaked or leaked. I shouldn't say that. announced or not. And he is, you know, buddy with Trump. So the corruption that's potentially there, all of the checks and balances, they do their job in theory, but it takes forever. And yeah, it's really, I feel like we all just need a group hug and I don't know, some time with our Canadian friends. I don't know. We're really, pretty exhausting.
You were in Sweden. Everything was maybe everything was not fine in Sweden, but yeah.
It was pretty good in Sweden. It was pretty good in Sweden. In fact, I looked up the news there. I'm like, what is actually happening there? And it's still just kind of fun and sweet. And yeah, they have some problems, of course, you know.
Yeah.
I learned that. I didn't know this, but the most ISIS members as European citizens come from Belgium and Sweden. So that's the ugliest news I could find in Sweden.
And that's there's a big story about this, of course, which I think resonates with the US, is what do you do with the defeated ISIS members who want to come back to their countries that they left to fight the jihad, the holy war, and no one wants them. And it's like,
and we have a lot of women who have joined ISIS. That's a really common thing from the States. So,
and
they've
had children, and it's like every country is trying to invoke some kind of ancestry that makes those people not of that country to be able to say we don't want them here. And it's complicated because at the same time, some of them are showing no remorse. They're like, yeah, I went to fight against, you know, the corrupt Western world and I'll do it again. And they're like, I think it's probably the most humane human thing to do to bring them back and put them in prison, probably. But can you blame someone for saying it's probably best if you don't come back? I don't know.
We need our own little island somewhere.
Yeah. And yeah, because that's the thing. What do you do with them? Do you leave them like to be literally condemned to death in the country they're in, even though they are actually a citizen of your own country? I don't know. It's a complicated one and one we could discuss for a long time, but right. Okay. Well, thanks for the report on America and Sweden and America in general. I'll talk about France for just a second because it's very short. And I'm sorry, I don't have a lot to report on because it's the continuation of what's been happening in the past few months. It's essentially the follow-up to the Gilets Jaunes movement and the continued distrust of the government who's trying to regain the love of the public opinion, trying to do it. It's difficult to evaluate because the voices you hear the most are, of course, the voices of the people who are unhappy. But we have European elections in a couple of months here, and it's looking like the Gilets Jaunes movement might have been just, obviously because it's disorganized, disorderly enough that people have also lost trust in some people, of course, not all of them. I think a lot of people are still very much, you know, in the vein of the Gilets Jaunes movement. But there's a lot of people who are also getting back to the government thinking, all right, that's kind of enough. We need the country to function. And it might show in the as a surprise result in the European election. So we'll see what happens there. The results of the Grand Débat, the great debate that I talked about last episode, will be made public in the month of March. So I think at that point, things will move along a little bit. But for now, we're kind of in this weird holding pattern where we don't quite know where we are beyond the fact that some people are very unhappy and we don't quite know how to fix it. So we'll see. Dan, what's happening in Mexico?
As I mentioned at the beginning of the show, we are living interesting times. The previous time that I had the chance to be on the Phileas Club, we were about to have national elections in here. We were about to decide who was going to be the president for the country. And the winner is Andrés Manuel López Obrador, AMLO, as he's also known. And he represents a constant fight against the status quo. To be quite honest, I wasn't really sure. I expressed my skepticism for him to win. But he also represents the, let's say, like the anger of the people against the project that was being developed by the previous administration. And it actually didn't help the people who doesn't have as many money, as many resources as the higher classes. So he won with a big margin. And I am talking about between 60 and 70% of the votes. The cleanest elections that we have. That's also the ones where the real majority voted for him. And I perfectly understand that we needed a change. And he was the person who was pretty much with the flag of change, and he has been promoting this supposed change for at least 18 years, and this is where it comes to be something interesting in Mexico.
Let me interrupt you for just a second. Is there what kind of change is he talking about? Like, are we seeing the same kind of movement we've seen in other places, which is more popular classes feeling left, you know, feeling abandoned by the enrichment of other classes of the population and the world, or is it something different?
It's in that line exactly, and I also recommend strongly to the listeners to check a previous episode, particularly the one that you are interviewing Saul González about Venezuela. because that's actually let's say that we were in a similar position, not the same, just a little bit similar to what Venezuela was I don't know, like 12, 15 years ago, where a change was needed, and we had a figure that was representing this change. In that case was Chavez. I'm not trying to establish a direct relationship between Chavez and AMLO, but I am you saying that they were representing the change that most of the people wanted to see. And for example, in Mexico, we had one main party that was in government for about 70 years. Then it, we changed to a different party for 12 years. Then the original party came back for another 6 years, and then we have finally a change with AMLO. I am mentioning this because, for example, in some other countries, we talk about dictatorships. And in here in Mexico, after the Mexican Revolution, we pretty much had what has been called by historians as the perfect dictatorship, because it meant that the same group of power was keeping the power, but they just changed, they just switched the heads or the presidents, but the group remained the same. And that worked pretty much for 70 years. So then we had a change with a party that was more related to the right. The original party was more like in the center. And most of the people were, well, if the center didn't work and if the right didn't work, let's move to the left. AMLO, as I mentioned before, this was the third time that he was running for president. The first two times, it was a really close call. And there were some political mistakes actually made by him. But in the third time, he was also using or abusing the system. Because, for example, when you're running for president, you usually have, let's say, like 6 months, where you can do open campaign, where you can go traveling in the country and saying, well, you know, I am the best option. In his case, he was the best known option because he has been candidate, as I mentioned before, for three times. And during the last 6 years, instead of being part of a party, he created a movement. And actually his party, and I am using quotes in here, air quotes, is not actually, it doesn't have even the word party in the name. It's El Movimiento de Renovación Nacional, or National Renovation Movement, as it's called. And it was pretty much created for him to run as president. It didn't have a structure. Eventually, it gained some members of all parties, and it's where it comes to be kind of funny in a way, because he accepted people from the bad government, the mafia of power, as he tends to call him, la mafia del poder in Spanish. So he accepted corrupt members of different parties to make his party bigger, to have more presence in different parts of the country. But he pretty much appeared in all the publicity for different candidates. So he has been running with his image for more than 6 years. So he had an extended campaign, and that actually helped him to be more in the presence of the mind of the voters.
So he was partnering with people who were already in the public eye by sort of tagging along in their campaigns, and that would increase his visibility. And essentially, it was him campaigning without campaigning. Is what you're
saying. But also, and I want to make to clarify one point. It's more like they were tagging along with him. If you saw, for example, a candidate advertisement, a candidate banner in a different state of the country, you saw at the left, yes, the picture of the candidate, Juan Perez, just to say one name, a fictitious name, John Smith. And at the right, in the very same banner with the bigger a bigger picture, you saw AMLO. So it's like, okay, I'm going to vote for the smaller picture in the left, but he's representing the guy in the big picture on the right. And most of the people actually see as that. We had also different elections for different states and municipalities in Mexico City. And most of the people were following what we call the efecto AMLO, or the AMLO effect, that is like, I'm going to vote just for the party because the leader of the party is this guy. I don't care if the other people is a corrupt person or something that I really don't care. But he represents the party that it's representing the member that it's going to bring change in Mexico.
Is that illegal? You were saying it was bordering on illegal.
Yes, because you cannot do campaigning for, let's say, longer than 6 months, and he was doing it for over 6 years. It's perhaps just a small mistake. I actually don't want to overblow that, but that's what helped him a lot to be in the presence of the mind.
How long has he been president now?
He's about to enter the 88. He's about to go into 90 days. So
So I guess it's still very early to be judging what's happened. But maybe you can tell us how the first 3 months have gone.
Yeah, we have some things, and I mentioned at the beginning that perhaps we're living in the best of times or the worst of times. That it all depends who you ask. For most of the people, he actually right now has a rating approval of 80%. It actually grew from the voters, and he has more acceptance from most of the people in the country. But if you ask, let's say, the people who is, I don't want to use this word, but more informed, the people who know more about economics, who actually read what he's proposing, that 20%, perhaps it's a smaller percentage, but they are actually getting stronger in the criticism of the measurements. Mm. And there are some reasons for
you
that.
You seem to be dancing around the fact that you're not a fan.
No, and I say it publicly. I am not a fan, but I want to present as close to objective opinion in this case. But
yeah,
I
no,
am openly
fair.
Against him. So that's,
why?
That's not a secret.
Tell us what you think he's not doing right.
Okay.
And maybe what you think he might be doing right, if there are some things you think. I don't want to, you know, cast a negative light a priori.
Don't worry, and he actually has done a lot of stuff right. For example, he has elected a person for public positions in the government that are actually the people that know the most about the different topics. But he also has elected some people that are not, let's say, the best fitted for a lot of departments. Some of the examples that happened during the last month, for example, we have the CONACYT, which is an organization that is in charge of technological and scientific projects here in Mexico. And in there, there were a couple of positions that were filled with people that are not, that are, let's say, like more in the line of the president, but they are not the ones who have the best knowledge for the positions. Two of those positions were one filled for one guy who actually didn't finish his studies. He was, I don't know, like in the second or third semester of his bachelor degree, but he got a coordination of one of the departments. And a lot of people were like, okay, so he's getting a salary that is like, I don't know, like three times or two times better than most of the people. And he's not qualified for this position. Okay, perhaps it was a mistake, or perhaps he has different qualities that are not being reflected by the degrees that he has earned. But they also had in a different department in the same CONACYT, one person whose only experience was that she was a fashion designer. And she was in charge of one of the departments of science and technology. So there were some problems in there. After this came to light, the first guy that I mentioned, he quit. He said, like, okay, I don't want to be in any problem. I didn't want this charge, so I am going to leave. And in the second position, they were like, okay, but she has a lot of experience. Yes, show me the money. Tell me where is her experience. She actually was fired.
Okay. All right. But that seems like, you know, I don't want to be dismissive, but small instances of corruption, right?
Yes.
It's not big policies. Or, yeah.
Yeah, but that is like perhaps a small step. We have three major instances and that came, for example, like populist movements. From the time that he came to power, he had very specific promises. For example, one of these was to cancel the airport that was being built at the time. And actually mentioned that in the previous episode that I have the chance to participate. But it was canceled just because it represented the old government. It was going to bring a lot of improvements because the local airport that we have right now in Mexico City is insufficient. Mexico City is an area where it's really difficult to land a plane because we're all surrounded by mountains. So they're going to build a bigger airport to improve this. He just pretty much said, okay, one of my promises is that I was going to cancel in here. However, I'm going to listen to the people. I'm going to listen to the pueblo sabio, as he says, the wise people. And he made like a national poll, which was with a lot of irregularities. It wasn't directed or coordinated by any of the official instances that we have, like the ones that run the elections. It was just elected by people who was in favor of his party. And these elections were taking place in places where the majority of people voted in favor of his party. So, for example, you have elections all around the country to vote about an airport that is going to be built. Well, actually, it's already been built. It's it has a 30% of advantage. We're going to make a poll. And people from Tabasco, from Baja California, for a different part where we have a strong presence, are going to vote about this. And of course, he got the numbers because it was a poll that was already pre-designed in his favor. After that, he made a different poll.
Again, I don't want to dismiss your concerns. I'm curious if the other people on the show have the same impression as I do. And maybe that says something about the world we live in. But it feels like when someone isn't saying, I'm going to talk about Brazil for a second, but like, we should kill black people in the street, then it's really not a big deal what you know, the scandal is. And the impression I get, basically, if the people we don't like aren't Trump or Kim Jong-un or Bolsonaro or people like that, then it's like, yeah, you know, he's a politician, whatever. Do you feel that way, Marlene, maybe? I know you have your problems with your own populists at the moment, but I'm listening to Dan and I'm like, that doesn't seem like such a big deal.
It does sound like in Dutch you would use the word, it's a luxury problem to have. If these are the kinds of scandals. On the other hand, I can imagine that if you see that corruption is a really big issue, especially if really grotesque corruption, maybe like an issue elsewhere on your continent, I can imagine that signs of corruption, like, they weigh heavier. I could imagine... Right. That would have an impact. I don't know if it feels like that for you, Dan. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I could imagine that sort of when it reeks of corruption, like, this is not the road we want to go on.
Especially when the guy is coming in saying, we're going to change things.
Yeah.
Yeah. And for example, just to finish the previous point, and I mentioned the national polls because we had the third one this last weekend. The second one was for a project that the president was all in favor. So pretty much it was like, let's pretend that we're going to have a poll. He won the votes to get pretty much a train that is going to go all around the southeastern part in the country, which is where most of the poverty is. And pretty much went as he expected. He proposed to build the train. The local some people of the local communities were against it, but well, the majority won. And the last poll that we had the last weekend was for the building of a thermoelectric plant in Morelos. And as once again, the result was exactly what the president was expecting. However, it's kind of shady in the case that about 1 week before, the main opposition of this plant that was actually built, that was a project from previous administrations, Samir Flores is his name, he was killed. And with killed, I mean like a couple of people went in front of his house and actually just gunned him. This is a different part. I'm not blaming the government about this. However, it's kind of interesting. The people who is in favor say, okay, perhaps it's part of the members of the opposition that want him to have a bad image, and it's actually a perfectly valid point in this case. However, it's kind of interesting how the information is being presented. To finish the point. Oh yeah.
When you say polls, do you mean actual votes where you have voting stations and everyone goes to vote, or?
Yes.
Every few weeks there's an actual vote on a referendum kind of thing.
Yes, right? It's sort of a referendum, and I don't want to call it like that or like official elections because he's not using the proper organism for these polls. And as I mentioned, I participated in the first two, actually. I went to vote. I had to go. They give you a ballot, but they don't even have a number in there. So if you want to check the votes, it's impossible. You can pretty much falsify the information, and perhaps that was missing when I was starting to tell about this, because those are the practices that the old system, that the old parties that I was mentioning were using. So if we're supposed to go with a change, if we're supposed to be, his main point was that we're going to solve everything in Mexico by fighting the corruption. what is the formula that you're going to do that to improve the people of in the poorest areas? Well, I don't know, but we're going to fight the corrupt people. And then you see that he's hiring people from the corrupt parties to help him in his party. I know that it's politics, and you have to agree on a lot of points, and you have to get the people who is the most valuable. But you are doing some of the same practices that the other parties that you were criticizing were doing. And this is the final point. Sorry if I am taking the mic for too long. Is that, for example, he's supposed to represent change, and he has been fighting for so long for this change. And most of the proposals that he's doing are involving in taking the power of the different organizations, for example, the Supreme Court here in Mexico, and having all in his favor. Some of the other points that were being made actually a couple of weeks ago, and the last week we had the resolution, is that we're going to have a civil guard, a civil army that is going to be fighting because the local police is insufficient to fight the problems that we have with drug lords. So the first proposal was rejected for the opposition. But the majority of the people in the Congress is in the party of Morena. So, but he needed absolute majority. For the absolute majority in the Senate, he needed nine people to be on his side from the opposition. One day before the election was being made, nine people from one of the other party, the other parties from the PRD, el PRD, renounced their party and moved to the other party. So it's like, wait a minute. We have the elections at the next day for the civil guard. And they check the information. They change a lot of the things because we want more people, not just the army, involved in this initiative. And actually, they did a lot of improvements on the law. And actually, all the parties voted for this. And you read the final draft of this, and it's like, okay, I am in favor of this. But the original proposal that the rest of the parties were against is not representing this. I am really glad that the representatives actually had the courage and did their work. And working in this, but for example, this kind of perhaps nitpicking that I am doing with some of the situation doesn't speak really well about the rest of the movement.
It's certainly.
Yeah, I can see that.
Go ahead,
Marley. There's a lot of baggage. Well, I would. It appears that there's indeed a lot of baggage. So you know, it's not just these little signs. Like, well, they're just little signs. No, they stand for something much bigger, and I can really understand the way you explain it. I can really understand that it's more than that. Yeah,
I have to agree that, like, especially the voting thing, feels like, wait, you're this is serious stuff. You have to be sure that things are controlled the way they should be, otherwise that is the definition of corruption, right? Or
also perhaps we are not voting we're not having a Brexit vote because we're not voting in huge world-changing situations. We're not living.
No,
the,
but if it's a referendum,
Americas.
it's a referendum, and you're supposed to listen to the voice of the people. And it doesn't matter that it's for Brexit or, you know, what color should the car of the president be. If it's a referendum, it's the principle of the thing. You're doing an actual referendum.
So. And also, this comes after you won in one of the cleanest elections. So why don't follow that path? Okay, so that's pretty much what is happening here.
Yeah, it's not Brazil or Venezuela levels of concern, but I see where your concern is coming from.
Just one final thing, and this is the real final. The opposition, the people at the right, are saying that this is how Venezuela started. I don't believe it. I don't believe it by far. Perhaps we have some of these tiny problems that we have expressed that we have to be checking in here, but also, as I mentioned, never listen to the people who is in the extremes, neither in the right or the left.
Yeah, I agree with that. I have to say, we're not hearing about Mexico at all in France.
No.
You neither?
Not in Holland either, no. Actually,
what about
not in the Netherlands either.
What about the U.S.? Is it like it's your neighbor?
Yeah, well, we only talk about building a wall there. So that's... we basically... And actually today, this is horrible, but there a study came out that showed that within the last 3 years, there's been 4,500 allegations of sexual abuse and harassment in the detaining centers along the border with kids. So our news about Mexico is just how badly we treat them. So that's it's terrible, but that's what we hear is build a wall or wow, look how inhumane we are. So one of those two.
Is the wall done? It feels like the government shutdown is over and he's not going to get his wall.
No, but he has claimed it's a national emergency. And just speaking to sort of this feeling that you were referring to with this leader who's claiming to create change and to do things differently, and really you just see the same old stuff, is that core feeling of being lied to. You know, as humans, we are evolved to have relationships with the person in front of us. And when that person deceives us and gaslights us and tricks us and whatever, it really is a major rupture in our lives, right? And now we have the whole world to look at and be lied to from. So we're not quite evolved to fully handle what that looks like. And so that feeling is so personal and painful and awful. And I think, you know, in the end, what happens, at least in my experience being back in the States, and I still have a little space of like, oh, these Americans. So it's kind of nice, but I think it's going to go away. But anyway, this feeling of, so Trump's claiming it's a national emergency. In the speech where he claimed or called for a national emergency, he literally said, I don't have to do this if you guys would just build my wall. It's like, that's not the definition of an emergency. And so, you know, within all of that, so essentially what's happened is he has the power to do that. And then, but what he's done is he's going to divert all this funding to this wall away from military efforts other places. That's where he'll get that emergency money. And it's a lot.
So he's still going to do it by defunding other things.
No, I don't know if you've met him. He does not quit without being arrested, I think. But anyway, so he, so that's what he's claiming. And so the House has got enough votes and has essentially said no way, because he's taking over their job, which is to decide the funding. And so there will be so many lawsuits. And he said in his speech, I'm going to get sued like crazy. But I'm going to tell you right now, we elected a man who is not comfortable unless he's being sued 1,000 times over. Like this, everything that works with normal people is the opposite for him. And so, so he's going to try to, and he's thin-skinned, and conservative pundits said, you're a baby and you didn't promise the one thing you promised, which is the wall. And that's why the government shut down. That's why he's not going to give this up.
Right.
My hope is that it'll blow up and he won't win again.
And if he doesn't win again, then you think the wall will go away.
Right. I think here's the problem with the whole concept of the wall is there is a plenty of wall already existing. The places that he wants to put it are places mountainous. You can't cross anyway. And the things he's claiming, the drugs or the criminals that get through, they go through ports of entry.
No. I realize the wall is kind of stupid, but
Well, what? And he does, he's a master manipulator in this sense. He'll say, well, the wall's already being built. And look, we've already got a bunch done. A day before, he's like, we need a wall. So it doesn't, and the people who love him, it doesn't matter what he says. And I think that's the hard part for thinking people. They're sort of like, wait a minute, hold on, look at evidence. And they just want to believe what he says. So that's tricky.
Just one really fast point
here. I wanted to ask
you
about the wall.
And the point that I wanted to make is that we're not paying for that wall. That's what he has been insisting. but that's the thing, because he's using federal fundings. He's funding using, for example, maintenance, part of the budget for maintenance in the so-called wall or the fence. But as Wendy was telling, well, part of that you are taking credit was already there. So in a way, for example, we had reports of zombie deers in the southern part of the United States. So we were like, come on, please build a wall, because we want to be protected from the zombie deers from the United States.
So we should make it mutually beneficial there. Yeah, and, exactly. And really, technology and increased sort of pay for the people working right there, that's what stops the problems. And then obviously taking care of these kids that have crossed alone. And, you know, I mean, it's just stupid use of money, and he knows it. In fact, there's a video you could find that is amazing where he's at the border, and he loves to have lots of guns and drugs on tables around him, you know, like, wah. I mean, he's such a TV guy. It's so annoying. Anyway, and he's talking to someone about the wall and how it's like impenetrable and it's amazing. And the woman is just like deadpanned, is like, well, actually, you can climb under it, or you could Probably get over it. You could also just cut it with a saw that you could buy at Home Depot.
Yeah, I don't know. Have you heard about El Chapo, who actually, is going to be moved to Alcatraz to spend a life sentence in there? Well, I don't know. Have you heard? But he was an expert on building tunnels. So I don't know how much of a help will be a wall against this kind of organization. So.
Right.
Yeah. I think everyone agrees that the wall is probably not going to be. I guess the argument is, yeah, but it will stop a little bit, which is better than nothing. And yeah, anyway. All right. This is not the wall episode, but we're probably all in agreement about that stupid wall. It's what I think what we would all agree on is that it's not worth it. Whether or not it's efficient or it would work a little bit or a lot, I think the amount of money that's going to be sunk into it is not worth it. All right. Anyway, go ahead, Marlene.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I cannot believe that people can hear this man talk and say that he represents strength or power. I mean, the only thing I can see when or hear when I look at this man is he's a small child who cannot get over that he cannot get his way. It is incredible. And then on the other hand, I mean, the only thing that he wants a wall for, and that I feel at least a part of the people that support him in wanting to build a wall for, is to be able to say, you don't belong here. And, you know, the wall doesn't even have to be real, because he can just say that. And that's and I think, you know, because that's the same thing that we see in the part of the way the role immigration played in the Brexit discussion. It's the same with populism on the rise in Europe. The only thing is symbolic politics to say, I look at you, I do not recognize myself in you. So that must mean that you do not belong here.
So
really sad.
Yes. While I agree with what you're saying, I also feel compelled to point out the fact that this is a way of looking at it that is extremely one-sided. And it's my way of looking at it as well, but it kind of simplifies the entire debate. I think there are reasons, good or bad, to think about immigration. And the way you're portraying it is kind of dismissing the entire conversation about immigration. And I understand you're doing this because the way the conversation is being had in that instance and in many instances is deceptive. But I think that over the course of the 10 minutes we've discussed this wall, and we have kind of let ourselves slide into a very tunnel vision view of the issue. And that's a function of the fact that we are all in agreement. And I also acknowledge the fact that that wall, I don't think, is a good idea. I acknowledge the fact that Trump is an angry child. But there are some people who think that some of the things he's saying make sense. And I think if you are willing to listen to it in the way that they do, it's not incoherent. There are some things, some frustrations that he's expressing that do make sense. And dismissing them as we have here in the past 10 minutes, I don't think are productive, not just because it's talking about something that is factually wrong, which it might be, I think it is, but also because it, in the same fell swoop, dismisses the concerns. And it says to the people who are concerned, you are not important and your opinion doesn't matter. And we kind of implicitly call them idiots. And we've sort of, you know, said this a little bit here and there. And if this show has taught me anything, it's that some people might not be as informed and some people like us might believe certain things, but the the feelings of the people who do vote for the Brexit or who do vote for Trump come from a place that is just as real as the place that our feelings come from. And they're very often not as caricatural as we let ourselves picture them. So I don't, I'm talking in general terms, but it's so easy for us to slide into that because there's, I think, a lot of right in the way we talk about all of this. But we're throwing away the bits that make sense in the other side of the argument. And that's why the incredibly adversarial conversations happen. And I'm convinced, Marlene, that if you had someone, of course, you know, there are, I'm going to use the term, there are the actual deplorables that we can't really have a conversation with. But I'm pretty certain that if you had a conversation with someone normal who thinks the world might be a good idea, or at the very least that, you know, immigration has to come under control, et cetera, et cetera, I don't think you would be as vehement in your condemnation of all of this. Maybe I'm wrong, but...
Well, let me clarify, because it was lazy of me to put it that way. I should have explained more. Like,
I'm not trying to pick on you, by the way. I'm sorry to... I'm not pointing fingers, but we all did it now in this conversation.
I realize what you're doing. I'm not trying to say that there's no... that there are no issues with immigration. And I definitely do not want to say that people who honestly feel scared and people whose income hasn't risen, people who have trouble finding housing, who feel that, you know, they don't have access to the things that they have a right to have access to. I'm not trying to say, and I realize that in putting it the way that I did just now, that was way too easy to read it that way. That's definitely on me. I don't mean to say that those feelings aren't real, because if you feel that way, those feelings are real. That you know, that's the thing. What I am trying to say is that especially the symbol of a wall, I think, because all of these studies have shown that it just, you know, all the data that Wendy just told us, the wall will not help.
I agree.
What it will do is show that, you know, that people we associate with, because it's the same with discussions about, you know, closing the borders and refugees, I think in a lot of it in the Netherlands as well. We really need to wrap our heads around that we cannot decide on the way a person looks, that they obviously must not belong here. We really must get easy with a society that looks different from just me, myself.
I think there's a lot of that for sure in the conversations we're having everywhere. I think it's the expression that we see of the unease in all of our countries, or most of our countries. But I also, you know, if you asked someone, and we do that on the show very often, but if you ask someone about that, they would tell you, obviously, I don't have a problem with the way people look. Again, if you accept the deplorables, that's not the issue. The issue is wider immigration. But so the quality of your connection is a little bit off, Marlene, so it's a little bit hard hear you. But you know what? We could talk about this for a while. Since it's related, let's talk about what's been happening in the Netherlands, because it also has a lot to do with immigration, is my understanding.
Well, it's just we also will have on March 20th, we will have new elections, not for the general government. We will have the state's provincial elections, which is just like sort of in between the municipalities and the main government, so the provinces. But together with that, we will have our elections. And I'm sorry, the states, provincial, are important because those people elect the people that will sit in our Senate. And that's why this discussion, the changing political landscape is relevant, because if we make very different decisions for these provincial elections, they will elect different party members for the Senate. So the government will have a problem to get their new laws through the Senate. Mm. Is that clear?
Yeah, yeah.
So that's one thing. The other thing we will have elections for is one of the oldest governmental parts in our country, which has sort of the worst name you can imagine, because they are called the water boards.
Okay.
Which are, in fact, the Dutch are a country, we have a long history of fighting the water. And the oldest water boards, who are in fact in charge of water barriers, water quality, water levels, all that kind of stuff, which is, in a country with so many polders as the Dutch, it's really quite important.
Right.
And they're actually among the old. I looked it up. My water board was founded in the year 1319.
Nice.
So that's really, and that has been a continual sort of governmental body. So that it really is important. It is also probably the election that has the most difficult time to get people to the voting booths, because it feels, we're really used to that stuff just being managed.
Right.
Just being managed. It is really not
Does it get political on the water boards? It's never not going to be weird, by the way. On the water boards election, does it get political? Is there like strong leftist and right-wing leaning personalities that think the way the water board should be managed should be different?
I am going to be real honest. I haven't looked enough into it myself. I'm so sorry. I know, but that's the thing, it feels far away, but I do have the intention of looking more into it. I mean, I know that it has to do, because it's also a different part of government. So it's a different way we pay taxes as well, because obviously, the dikes must be maintained. That is clear to at least most people in the west of the country. I think it's mostly about water and nature quality and and also about transport by ship
it's fine. I think the if you don't know everything, every little detail about the water board, I'm surprised regular people vote on that. I would figure the government would manage it somehow, and you get your management done through voting in the other type of elections. But
well, in that case, there is actually a very, very important reason why they're not, for example, not matched up with the provinces. And it is very interesting, I think, because it is also related to, all these other border issues. Because this way of organizing it recognizes that natural borders and waterways do not match up with political boundaries. And that is the reason why they're organized in a different way. So in that case, I actually do think it's relevant.
Interesting. So it separates the power of management and of decision of the natural borders and the political borders, and that's an intentional political design. That's pretty
natural borders only in the way where it means water, but then again, the Dutch have natural borders
right.
When it comes to water. So yeah.
Interesting.
However, okay. I'm pretty offended that you have not caught on, Patrick, to the big fight between the Dutch and the French.
I actually have not heard of this. You messaged me earlier. What is happening? Why are we angry at each other? I didn't realize.
Yeah, no. So this is the perfect example of exactly why the Dutch are so like, or I mean, you know, some in the Dutch government are so offended by the French, because our Dutch Minister of Finance was asked just this morning by a honest to God journalist a very serious question. So are you sure we are not fighting with the French? And I came across the quote and I thought it was just the perfect topic for today, because you know, we the Dutch are a trading nation. We are very, very proud of our harbor in Rotterdam, and we are very, very proud of our airport in Amsterdam, because it's a really, really important airport for all of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
We have one major Dutch airline. It's called KLM, and it stands for the Royal Airline, which is, they also have a crown in their logo because, you know, we're still a kingdom. And the reason is, a couple years ago, quite a few years ago, KLM merged with Air France. And it was always portrayed to the Dutch that this would be like a very equal partnership between these two companies.
Uh-huh.
The Dutch state sold their shares, and the French didn't. And so the Dutch sold their shares in KLM, and the French didn't sell them in Air France. And just yesterday, it was announced that without informing the French, secretly, the Dutch government had bought new shares in KLM, because obviously they were such good buddies. Because that's what you do.
So does the Dutch government have an increased controlling interest in the company now?
Not yet. They have an increased interest because if I understood correctly, they sold about everything, if I got that right. They bought up, I think, 12.8% or something of the shares.
Yeah, that's not insignificant.
That's not insignificant, especially when they said, so this is what happened. And 1 hour before the press conference, they called Mark Rutte, our prime minister, called your head of government, and our minister of finance called his French counterpart just 1 hour before the press conference to inform them of this fact. And during the press conference, they proclaimed that they now had 12.8% of the shares, and they were intended to match, you know, to grow just a little, just to match the shares that the French government has.
That's very cute. I'm sure it will work out fine.
And you haven't heard anything about it. And for weeks, like, it has been like a major thing in Dutch news, because apparently Air France had a new CEO or something, and the question was the head of KLM allowed to remain the head of KLM? And apparently there were suggestions that he should be, you know, moved to a different place or replaced by somebody, whatever. And because Schiphol, I'm sorry, Amsterdam Airport, which we call Schiphol.
Yeah, I've been there. Amsterdam it's Airport,
nice. Yeah, it's very nice. It has apparently very good signage. People from all over the world come to Schiphol Airport to learn how to do readable legible signage across airports. So yeah, so Schiphol Airport is sort of like the home airport of KLM, KLM. There was question if KLM was allowed to remain their own brand, and that really hurt in Holland. Yeah.
It's really funny, you know. This is the kind of thing that we and I listen to news reports. Maybe not every day, but a few times a week. And I have never heard about this story ever. So maybe it was one of the days I missed. It's possible. But the more likely situation is that we don't really care as much.
I'm sorry. It's different because if I remember correctly, like years ago when they announced this merger, I'm pretty sure it was a surprise for everyone, for everyone on the board of KLM, as well as in the Dutch government, that the new company wasn't even going to be called Air France KLM. It would just remain Air France. And they found out during the press conference, and they were like, but this was supposed to be an equal partnership. Like, but we're all going to be called Air France.
Yes, so, and Air France will be a big family. Yeah. Listen, we're used to these kinds of getting people who maybe don't necessarily want to be French and telling them that they're French now, but like not really equal type of French. We're used to that. All right. The connection is kind of bad, Marlene. I'm sorry. I think it's a little bit difficult to hear you, as I was saying. But thank you for these refreshing bits of news. I was fully expecting you to rant about nationalism and the sad state of the world. It turns out you're the only one who didn't. So thank you very much. And I think that's going to be it. I do feel like I would want to talk about other things and talk about the wall a little bit more, but maybe we've talked about it enough. And I'm going to end the show here. So thank you very much to Marlene, Dan, and Wendy for being on the show. If people want to get more, let's say, from what is now has now been christened the Sweden of the US and about Wendy, where would they go, I wonder? Are you still maintaining that Instagram account?
I am. So it's Wendy with an I, Dunford, and that's on Instagram. And then you can find my therapeutic musings on therapythursdays.com.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Dan, what about you?
Well, it's really the easiest way is just to find me on Twitter as Dan Campos. From there, you will find links to all the videos and shows that I do. And I just want to mention one of the latest where we talk about the implications of what it means for, in this case, for Mexico, for the society, for the film industry, the award ceremony that was with the Academy Awards. And just one little tease, we actually talk about who was the real winner of the Cinematography Award, and it wasn't the one that was presented on the ceremony. So there you have it. You can follow that information. That's just a tease. I can tell you after we finish the recording, or you can ask me about that in Twitter.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Dan. Marlene, what about you? Do you have any online place to direct people?
I do. I'm on Twitter at Monxies, which is Monxies, which is probably impossible to understand. With a bad connection, but I'm pretty sure you'll put it in the show notes.
Yes, I will. Absolutely. So thanks.
And promise that I do not only rant about populism, I also show pictures of awesome stuff I make, and I have many conversations about Dungeons & Dragons because it's the most awesome hobby to have.
Oh, really? Have you just started playing Dungeons & Dragons? Or
No, for a couple years, but tonight is my next session, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Excellent. Well, I've been a Dungeons & Dragons player for a long time. I haven't played in a while, but it occupied a lot of my life, so I'm very glad that you can enjoy it too. And for me, it's Not Patrick on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And of course, the show is at frenchspin.com. You can go comment there and let us know what you think about what we discussed. And you can also support the show at patreon.com/thephileasclub. The link is also in the show notes. If you enjoy the show, if you think it brings something to your life, consider giving us a couple of bucks. That would be very much appreciated. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back in a few weeks for another episode. Talk to you then. Bye.